Welcome to Alter Everything, a podcast about data science and analytics culture. I'm Neil Ryan, and I'll be your host. We're joined by Stan Van Gundy, legendary NBA coach and executive, for a chat about the past, present, and future of sports analytics. Let's get started. Stan, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, well, I am a massive, long-time, lifelong NBA fan, so it's an honor for me to be able to talk to you at all. This is a data and analytics podcast, so we might actually have some listeners that don't know who you are. So for their benefit, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I'm a I'm not coaching right now, but my career has been as a basketball coach, 14 years in college basketball, and a little over 20 years in the NBA, 11 of them as a head coach in Miami, Orlando, and Detroit.
So I think I first became a fan of yours back in those Orlando days. I was a big fan of, Dwight Howard. Honing in on the theme of the show, data and analytics, to me, that was one of the first times I'd seen kind of that real emphasis on the inside-outside game. You know, if you're not going to get a dunk, you might as well get a three-pointer. Was that how you were thinking about it, or was that just kind of the matter of the personnel you had at the time?
Well, it was a little bit of both. I mean, it certainly was at the very beginning of the three-pointer becoming a bigger part of the game. We had a team with Dwight Howard, a great big guy, that defenses had to collapse into the paint to try to take away his scoring, which opened up three-point shooting. And if we could make threes, then the paint would open back up for Dwight. And so things sort of worked in tandem. But that was the first time that I remember, really starting to give some of the analytic-type information to our players. And so we did talk about what the most efficient shots were, at least from a league-wide perspective, is the way we started, with the most efficient shot being the free throw. So if we can get fouled and get to the free throw line, we're going to get about a point and a half per possession. If we can get a layup, which was anything inside 3 feet, that little arc you see near the basket, that was going to be about a 61% shot at that time, and pretty close to that now in the NBA. So we were going to get 1.2 points per one of those shots. And at that time, the three-point shot overall was about 37%. And so we were going to get about 1.11 points per possession. And we brought that out to guys, but then also individualized it to what their abilities were and everything else, to talk about the best shots that we could do, that we could get as a team. So that was sort of the start of us using it with our players. I mean, we've used analytics in the past in a player personnel type of area, to try to decide which players you want on your team to trade for, to sign as free agents, to draft, things like that. But my time in Orlando was the first time we sat down with the players and tried to get them to understand the analytics behind our offensive and defensive philosophies.
Cool. So that was kind of when you started first talking about it with your team. Do you think that's kind of league-wide? That's about when it started catching on like that as well?
Yeah, I think it's only increased from there. And always there's, people probably ahead of the game and behind the game. I'm not sure that we were ahead of the game. We were probably right there in the middle. But I think it started with most people with that whole shot efficiency type of analysis. What type of shots are best for us to get as a team? What do we need to prevent in general when we're developing a defensive system? That sort of thing, I think, is where it started.
Yeah, I'm trying to compare in my head when that was compared to like when Moneyball was written. I'm wondering if that's, you know, when analytics started catching on across all of professional sports, or that's just when it started getting big in basketball.
Well, baseball's always been ahead of basketball. There's no question about that. I mean, you can go back to, you know, Bill James writing the Baseball Abstract. Goes back many years, and he was probably the first guy to really get deep into the analytics. And baseball, I think, is far ahead of everyone even now in terms of what they do with analytics. Part of it is the structure of the game, in that, you know, the game is a little easier to track. It starts always with a one-on-one matchup between the pitcher and the hitter. Every play is isolated. You know, the game is not as fast and up and down. And so baseball's always been ahead. But I do think that Moneyball's emphasis on trying to find market inefficiencies and trying to find things that were important to winning and success that were not the things, at least at that time, that are commanding big money, would give you a chance to compete on a budget. And so I think the other sports have picked up on that, albeit a little bit slower.
What about in terms of, you know, you said baseball has always been ahead in the use of analytics. What sport do you think it's had the most impact on the game itself? I'm just thinking, I read something recently that you know, home runs have gone up a lot since analytics have gotten bigger in baseball, but not nearly to the extent that three-pointers have gone up in the last few years in basketball.
Yeah, I would still say it's probably, I mean, it's affected basketball a lot, Neil, but I would still say probably baseball the most, like even beyond the home runs, you know, now you see a lot of shifting of the infield in baseball, particularly against left-handed hitters. You know, every at-bat, they pretty much are positioning the fielders based on their analytic information of where a guy hits certain pitches and things like that. We don't have it quite to that degree, but it has changed our game to the point of, obviously, the three-pointers have increased, and what's really decreased is shots in the mid-range. Everything from 4 feet to the three-point arc, shots that we, quite honestly, like when I was coming up playing the game, or anybody was at that time, shots that you used to work hard to try to get, and that teams in their execution tried to get, and individual players worked on, pull up jump shots from 15 feet. Those have become almost taboo on a lot of teams in the league. I mean, the Houston Rockets, probably the biggest example. They've got 2 years in a row now where they've shot more threes than twos. They literally don't want those shots at all. They either want to lay up, or they want a three-pointer, or they want to get to the free throw line. And it's a failed possession for them if they end up with a mid-range jump shot, a short runner, or anything like that. So it has definitely changed the game. It's changed the way players work on their skill development and everything else. And I think it's only going to continue in that direction. I don't think we're going to turn back.
Well, speaking as a fan rather than a coach, what is that good? Do you think that needs fixing? You know, the loss of the mid-range, is that hurting the game?
Well, I do think it's hurting the game, not so much from the losing the mid-range, but with the emphasis on a three-pointer. You know, when I first came in the league in the mid-90s as an assistant, I remember the rules were different at the time too, but certainly so was the offensive approach. And you know, you'd have four, five, six plays a game with these great athletes challenging a shot blocker where it's going to end up in a dunk or a block shot. And we don't see much of that anymore. I mean, it's pretty rare. If you have a full slate of NBA games on a night in the regular season, the highlights the next day, you might get one or two of those, because now I drive the ball, and if I'm going to be challenged at all, I'm just throwing the ball out to somebody stationed behind the three-point line, and they're shooting a three. And so to me, it's not, as a fan, it's not exciting to watch guys standing around shooting long-range shots. What's exciting is the athleticism of these great players. And I think it's a better game when we're seeing more of that and less of the stationary shooters. But the analytics will show you that the way the game is being played now is the most efficient way to play and gives you your best chance to win. And that's your job. So I don't know what could be done to change it, but I don't think our game's as exciting as it could be at this point.
What about a rule change? Do you think we'll have any of those in store? I mean, the three-point shot wasn't always a thing, right? They implemented it, what, around 1980? Is it time to move the three-point line back or make a four-point shot or something like that?
Well, I don't think we want a four-point shot. That's going to encourage more long-range shooting. There has been talk of moving the line back. There has been talk of keeping the line at the same distance all the way around because of the width of our court and having to fit the line in. You get a shorter shot in the corner. If you see an NBA arc, it arcs around to just below the free throw line, and then you get a straight line down from there to the corner. And so the corner three-pointer is a more efficient shot because it's a shorter shot. There has been some talk of just keeping the line at 23 feet, 9 inches all the way around would sort of make the corner shot almost an impossible shot to even get off from three. I think that could be a good thing for the league. But I don't think we're going to see it change anytime soon. I think the league tends to equate scoring with excitement, and scoring is up. They think that's exciting. I don't necessarily think the two correlate, but I think the people in charge do.
Okay. Which one do you like better? The making the distance the same all the way around, or even extending the distance so that the value of the shot is about the same as the value of a 2-point shot?
Yeah, I think either one would be effective. To at least reducing the role of three-pointers a little bit. I don't think it's a great game when we have one of our better teams that's taking more threes than twos. You know, look, I mean, this is an exaggeration, but if we go watch a bunch of middle-aged men play pickup games at the YMCA, we're going to see them stand around and shoot long-range set shots. I don't think that's what we want to watch when we get our best athletes on the floor. But again, I'm Neil. I'm a little bit in the minority here. I think the people in charge like the way the game is now. There's no problem with TV ratings or attendance or anything else. And so I guess the old line about, if it's not broke, don't fix it, is applying to the NBA at this point.
I'm in that old man YMCA game, by the way.
Yeah, there you go. And I mean, if I don't play much anymore, but if I go down and, you know, shoot on my basket outside, I mean, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to stand out there and fire long range shots. Now, granted, NBA players are going to do it at a high level, and you can certainly appreciate the skill involved. But I think that's different than the excitement of great athleticism, the quickness, the speed, the jumping ability, and everything else. So hopefully it'll all start to balance out. But I think that's going to take a lot of time and a lot of adjustment probably on the defensive end of things before we see more of that again.
Where do you think the players kind of stand on this right now? Like, obviously, to a good extent, they're buying in, right? Like, Harden doesn't take those mid-range twos. Curry doesn't take many of them. But then at the same time, I think I saw LeBron tweet at the end of a game last round, like, see, that's why I don't buy into the analytics. At the end of a game, a two-point shot is gonna win you the game. So do you think they're wishing it was kind of going back to the old days a little bit too?
Well, I think the players have a general understanding of, you know, the value of getting to the basket for layups and getting to the free throw line and having spacing on the floor and shooting threes. But they don't like hearing about the numbers all the time and the firm adherence to it. You know, and look, I also think what we're seeing now in the playoffs, I think the playoffs change things because you're playing against the best defenses who are also working hard to take away those high efficiency shots. And so what you're left with a lot is a mid-range jump shot. And we're seeing great success from Kevin Durant before he got hurt, shooting a lot of mid-range jump shots, and Kawhi Leonard with Toronto. And they're the two highest scoring players in the playoffs. So at the highest levels of our competition, the mid-range shot comes back to a level of importance. And that's why LeBron James and other players will point that out, because I think, you know, they want to go out and play basketball. And I think that they look at some of the analytics as trying to make them almost robotic, and they fight it a little bit, even though I think their generalized understanding of things is pretty good.
I wanted to switch gears a little bit and ask you about front offices. What are, because it's kind of mysterious to me. I know, you know, there are analytics departments in NBA teams now, but what are they like? Like, how big are analytics departments? What kind of skills do these people have, and how do they work with the GMs and the coaches?
Yeah, it varies. Certainly the size does. I mean, I think you've got Philadelphia probably being the biggest analytics department in the league. And I think they have 10 or 11 people now, several of them with PhDs, you know, highly, highly educated people. I mean, there's a real rush to, you know, hire people from the MITs of the world to come in and do these things. Some of the departments will be fairly small, 2-3 people. It started out, I think, with what people did is they got a lot of kids right out of college, very bright people, but that they could get pretty cheaply and they weren't spending a lot of money on it. Now there's people running analytics departments making as much as $600,000 a year. You know, so it's importance in the league. And I think that there's what they're the they'll help with coaching decisions, but the real crux of the thing is trying to find the best players for your team. And so the two areas people are really working on now is, and have been for a long time, is real predictive analysis on players. You know, certain types of players will maintain performance for a longer period of time. Let's say smaller players who rely on quickness, they tend to, you know, have their performance decrease pretty quickly when they hit about 30 years old, because the quickness starts to go. Bigger players tend to be able to continue pretty consistent performance for longer because, you know, 7 feet, still 7 feet, and quickness isn't as big a deal. And those are just two of the extreme examples, but trying to predict, we're going to sign this guy to a 4-year contract. What's his performance going to look like in year 4? And then the second thing I think that is really big, is, are there things we can do to prevent injuries to players? And you hear a lot of talk now in the NBA throughout the regular season. You see teams resting their best players, even when they're fully healthy. The term that comes up all the time is load management. And they're literally tracking. We can't do it in games, but in practice, they're literally wearing GPS devices and everything else to track the amount of work, how far they run, at what speeds, how high they jump, all of these things to calculate the load they're putting on their bodies and trying to find, you know, what are the optimal loads? When are we getting so far into, you know, too much work where a guy needs some rest or he's in danger of being hurt, but we've got to do enough work to optimize conditioning so he doesn't get hurt from being out of shape. That's sort of the holy grail right now, I think, of the analytics in, at least in the NBA, is the whole injury prevention, load management type of stuff.
What about when you were, well, I'm not sure, we didn't get to this in the intro, but you, I think you introduced yourself as a coach, but with the Pistons, you were president, you were running things as well, right? What was your analytics department like then?
Well, we came into basically having one person. We increased to three before we left and raised salaries and things. And look, I think that most of our use and probably the biggest use in the NBA is in terms of player personnel selection. Who are you going to draft? Who do you want to trade for? Who do you want to sign as free agents? What's the best cost of players and things like that? And so what you're really looking for is predictive analytics. Can we take individual players and predict based on their size, position, age, wear and tear, what they've done previously? Can we predict what they will be like, the performance we'll get, not only at the beginning of their contract, but if it's a 4 or 5 year contract, what it will look like at the end? That's one of the important uses. And then really now, I think in the NBA, the holy grail of analytics departments is trying to figure out how we minimize injury, because obviously your greatest assets are your best players, and having them on the floor for more games and more minutes is going to go a long way in determining your success. And, you know, what we're trying to do is, you know, players wear, a lot of them do, wear GPS monitors actually during practice, and you're monitoring, you know, how far they run in a given practice, how fast they run, how much acceleration, deceleration, how high are they jumping, how many times, you know, how often are they at maximum effort, and calculating within that, you know, what is the total load that these players are taking on, and how much is too much. If you get too much, you know, you're more susceptible to injury. At the same time, if you do too little, now you're not conditioned highly enough, and you're also vulnerable to injury. So where does the line, you know, where's the line of where you want to be in terms of how much work you give these players to do? Everybody's trying to figure that out at this point.
So the past of analytics in NBA franchises was kind of, you know, 2-point versus 3-point shot. The present is figuring out, you know, the best players to draft, and the future is player health. So am I getting that right?
I think you're right on that. I mean, it's still all of the other stuff, you know, because it's also, you know, which lineups work best together, which 5-person units work best together, you know, so you know who you need to put out there among your stars. I mean, it's a little bit of everything. The amount of information is overwhelming. Every NBA arena now required. Every NBA arena has a system of cameras in them that are, it's automatic. There's no camera operators. There's small cameras. And so every movement in an NBA game is tracked. So at the end of any NBA game, a coach can get a printout on, you know, how many miles a certain guy ran, at what speed. You know every shot, how close the nearest defender was. So was it an open shot, or was there somebody close to him? When it was somebody close to him, which defender was the closest? Are there certain defenders that are tougher to score on than others? I mean, the amount of information that is available to coaches and executives in the NBA is phenomenal. And the real challenge is figuring out what's most important, what can be most helpful to you in terms of winning and losing games and finding the best players and keeping them healthy and all of that, because every team is, privy to a lot of information.
Yeah. I guess, yeah, there's so much data out there. You have to know what questions to ask. I wanted to ask about your time at the Pistons. I believe when you were with the Pistons, you were one of only five people coaching and, being responsible for player personnel. What is that like? I mean, I guess at a high level, you're talking about balancing long-term strategy versus short-term tactics, and I guess there can be some give and pull there. But how did you get around that potential conflict of interest?
Yeah, well, I think I went out and hired a very good general manager, Jeff Bauer, who had actually done both jobs simultaneously when he was in New Orleans. He'd held about every job in the league, but had been a general manager and a successful one with New Orleans. And he really ran the front office on a day-to-day basis. If there was a decision to be made on a trade or a free agent signing, he compiled all the scouting information, all the analytic information, made his recommendations, and I just had to give a final yes or no. And I don't think he and I very often disagreed. So I wasn't really doing both jobs. I just had final say. I think the advantage to it, and it's not really in vogue. In fact, I don't think anybody is doing it now that Tom Thibodeau got fired in Minnesota during the season. I don't think any team has somebody doing both. It's not in vogue. I thought it was good because at least we had an overall philosophy and we were all on the same page. What you have in a lot of situations is you have differing philosophies. There's not a lot of synergy between the front office and the coaching staff. And then what happens is when things don't go well, it's basically, the front office wanting to blame the coaches wanting to blame the front office. When you have one person in charge of everything, you don't have any of that going on. So I think there are advantages to it also.
And then since then, did I read correctly? Did you just finish teaching a semester at Stetson University?
I did. I taught one class, one night a week for 3 hours, on just contemporary issues in sports. And we did a couple of weeks on analytics, salary cap, those types of things when we did the actual sports side of the business, looking at all the different leagues. And the feedback was from the students that, that was their favorite part of the course because it was new information for a lot of them.
Nice. So you've done a lot of stuff. Now you've been coaching for a long time. You did the GM thing. You taught a course. What's the proudest moment of your career so far?
That's really hard. I've been at this a long time, and it would probably go back to actual college coaching. And my wife and I had gone to a reunion of a small college team that I had coached back in the early 80s. We went there a year and a half ago and had all those guys come back. And to be honest, the proudest is when you see all the people that played for you there and how well they are doing. That's the proudest moment.
All right, Stan, I can't let you go before I ask you to make a prediction here. So as we're recording right now, the Raptors and the Bucks are locked up 2-2. Who do you got for that series?
I've got the Bucks winning it in seven games. I've been on the Bucks all year, so you know, I'll stick with them now, even though they had two tough ones in Toronto.
They're just gonna, both teams just gonna keep winning on their home court until it's over.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I think Milwaukee will win their two home games and win it. I think whoever wins it will beat Golden State in the finals, and I've been making that prediction for a couple of months.
You think they're going to beat Golden State?
I do. I just don't think Golden State's the best team. Now, they have done some phenomenal things since Kevin Durant got hurt that make you sort of second-guess yourself when you make that prediction, but I'll stick with it because I really do believe that Milwaukee is the best team out there, and I think Toronto's the second-best team out there.
Oh, okay. That's a bold one. I'm glad I got you. I'm glad I asked the question. All right. All right. Here we got the last segment of the show, the community picks. What's your pick, Stan?
Well, look, this time of year, you know, with college graduations going on, and I just had a daughter graduate, I love to go on and listen to commencement speeches. You know, nobody remembers who actually gave their own commencement speech, but I like listening to them. And so I'll give you two real quick. One from this year that I thought was really, really good was Savannah Guthrie from the Today Show at George Washington University. But my all-time favorite, and I listen to it every year when it comes this time of year, Michael Lewis at Princeton University, 2012. You can get it on YouTube. It's about 13 minutes long. And it's him talking about the role of luck in both life and careers. And Michael Lewis, of course, you know, is the guy who wrote Moneyball mm-hmm. that you mentioned earlier. The best commencement speech I have ever heard.
Oh, wow. Cool. Well, I'll check that out. I was actually just at GW. I'll give a shout out. My little brother graduated from law school there, but I did not get a chance to watch the commencement speech because my toddlers were going nuts and I had to take them outside. So my pick for the week is a new book on the NBA out pretty recently, Sprawl Ball by Kirk Goldsberry. So we were talking at length earlier about the evolution of the three-point shot. And so Kirk Goldsberry, longtime writer, professor, geographer, he's got a cool new book with a lot of cool illustrations talking about that evolution. So we'll put these links in the show notes. Stan, thanks again. I really can't thank you enough for joining the show. I'd love to talk about basketball with anybody, but I think this is definitely the best basketball conversation I've ever had. So thanks again.
Thank you, Neil. I appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in to Alter Everything. To share your thoughts and ideas for future episodes, join us at community.alterx.com/podcast or reach us on Twitter using the hashtag AlterEverythingPodcast. Have a unique story to tell? Send us an email at podcast@alterx.com. Catch you next time.
Well, Stan, you are by far the highest profile guest we've had on the show so far. But it was through Libby, my boss's boss, that we got you on here. So what's your relationship with her?
Okay. Well, I coached at Castleton State College in Vermont, and met my wife there. My wife was working in admissions. My wife and Libby both graduated from Castleton State and were best friends in college. And I met Libby through my wife, and Libby was in our wedding 31 years ago.
Do you have any funny stories about Libby? Libby is pretty, I'll say, serious at work. I'd like to know what she's like at a wedding.
Yeah, you know what? I don't have any funny stories, and I'm going to be honest, Neil. If I had one, I would not do that to her on this podcast. So, yes, I would not do that to her, and I would hope she would not do it to me. So, and you never want to mess with the boss. That's something I think we all need to learn in our careers.
All right. I guess you probably just saved my job.
Yes, probably.
All right. Thanks again, Stan.
No problem.